Thanks, Kristen. They accused me of being a little slow. I couldn't remember two names, so I just made it easy on myself. But this is the part I like. Whether it's the best part or not, this is the part I like. That's just my personal opinion, and I'm looking forward to hearing. I've heard of him. I know of him, and I've heard a lot of you know, most of what I've heard has all been good. He told me, he said, I'm just a regular drunk with good sponsorship, and I think most of us find ourselves in that way. But he's very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I do know that, and I'm looking forward to hearing him. So let's give a big Fellowship by the Sea hand to Jack from Ruston, Louisiana.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's been nice up until now. I'm Joe Reed, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
That's all right.
I've been called a lot worse than that. I like to thank the committee, Jay, and anybody else that had anything about doing getting me and my wife up here, because it's been a good time. Been a good weekend. I hadn't been to a bad one of these deals yet. And I hope y'all hadn't either, you know. We've been enjoying the fruit basket that was in our room, and I've got a couple that came with us over here, Jason and Susan. They come to keep me honest in that. But I knew my wife was going to be here, and she knows more about it than I do. And then I sponsored James over there. And, you know, it's very few places I go now that I don't run into somebody that I know in that. And that's been a gift that this program, Alcoholics Anonymous, has given me. They tell us, supposed to tell in a general way, you know, how it was, what happened, how it is now. I was raised down in South Louisiana. I came from a Cajun family. When I started school in the first grade, I had a hard time speaking English. And I still do. So if y'all need an interpreter, that's all right. We got one to get you. But my grandmother mother and father worked, and my grandmother lived with us, she spoke no English. So French was the language that was spoken at our home most of the time. And when I started school with a school teacher that didn't know how to talk any French, and they had a bunch of us little coonies running around there speaking French. And she didn't like that, so she tried to get it stopped. She called her parents in and told them to quit speaking French in our family, and that couldn't happen at ours because my grandmother lived with us. So I got in trouble with the teachers, and I didn't like school. And I wouldn't go if I didn't have to. And if they wouldn't catch me, a lot of times I wouldn't have to. And I lived in a town, Lake Charles, Louisiana, down around the Gulf. So I know about the Gulf. I've been around it most of my life. And, you know, it's a big body of water out here, too. Pretty good pond. When I was about the fifth grade, I was in the fifth grade. I got a bunch of us boys from school. We play what we call playing hooky from school. And we knew we wasn't going to be caught because it wasn't but 22 of us out of the same class that took off. And I've been real intelligent like that most of my life. And we went out there on a bayou. And we went to have some colored folks that lived not far from the woods out there that had some chickens and stuff, you know. And we went and stole a couple of chickens from their pen out there and went out to the bayou, and we skinned the chickens out. We had them on the fire roasting, and we all got caught. And I heard the judge sentenced me to LTI until I was 18 years old because we didn't go peaceful. And my parents got me out of that by moving me plumb out of the parish, which is county over here. And we moved out into another parish, and he sold his business and everything he had in town, moved us out in the country. And he put us to work. We had horses and we had cows, and you know, that was right up our alley. We loved it. I fell in love with the country. And we had about 100 head of Bremer cows that were running out on open range, so we had a good time penning cattle and doing stuff. But we penned the cows and he'd sell them. And he put us clean in new ground, and we built a dairy farm, and I was raised on that dairy farm. And after I moved out of Lake Charles, I got into sports, and I would keep my grades good enough where I could play ball. In a little C-class school, there wasn't but 112 of us from the first grade to the 12th grade. There was 11 in my graduation class. We had a real big graduation class that year. And there was six boys and five girls, so we could outvote the girls, you know, anytime we wanted to. But, you know, it was pretty good out there. You know, even back when I was just a small kid, my parents drank, but they wasn't like me. I never seen either one of them drunk. I seen my dad, what I called, you know, feeling pretty good a time or two, but that's about it, you know. And my older brother and I, when Dad would be drinking beer, we'd go up and ask him for a sip of beer, and he'd give it to us, you know. And I don't think that's what made me an alcoholic in it. I'm the only one in my family. There was five of us kids, and I had a brother and a sister older than me, and I had a brother and sister younger than me. And I was right in the middle. I never did fit. I was either too young to go with the oldest ones or too old to go with the youngest ones. So I just kind of felt out of place, you know. And parents were real good to us. I had no reason, you know. They'd done everything they could do for us. You know, my dad and that, they taught us how to work, you know, and gave us education, and I had no complaints about that. But there wasn't much activity where I live. We live 23 miles from the closest town. They almost had the pipeline sunshine down there to us, you know. And we used Hoo Owls for watchdogs. And it's a pretty good country place, you know. And we'd start, and they had a skating rink, you know, when I was in school. And that was the biggest thing we had, you know. We'd go out to this skating rink and roller skate. And most of the time when I went, I had to carry my baby sister with me, and because my oldest brother wouldn't let her go nowhere with her. So I'd carry her over to the skating ring, and a bunch of us boys would take off. You know, we'd run to the closest little town, and we'd buy us a few cans of beer, whatever money we could have, you know. And you start figuring real early, you know, how to do what you can do, you know, to be able to drink, especially when you get where you like it a little bit, you know. Like I say, we lived in the country, and everybody knew us, you know, and gravel roads and most everywhere we went. I had a car real young, and because we couldn't get through milking the cows and that to go to school. We'd done that, you know, kind of on purpose. And so the parents furnished a vehicle, and we'd get ready to go. We don't know we're going to party, you know, be two or three. I'd pick up two or three boys and go to the skating ring, and had my baby sister with. And we'd start down the road, and just pull over on the side of the road, and usually had a siphon can and a hose and a gas can, and we'd pull over the road, and I'd lift the hood and pull the car wire off the car where it wouldn't crank, and put the hood back down, and everybody, like I said, knew that stop and wanted to know was having problems. Oh, yeah, run out of gas. you know. But I got a gas can and a siphon hose. If you let us siphon about a gallon of gas out, that'd get us to the gas station. And we'd sit right there in that one place and fill the car up. So we didn't have to waste our money on gas. And we'd go, and like I say, we'd go every chance we got, and we'd go and drink. And first time I got in trouble again, real trouble, was after I left Lake Charles. Was two carloads of us went to a little town of Oberlin, Louisiana, and we went in this bar, and we were all underage. I was a junior in high school, and we went in this bar, and we had a drinking contest. And they said I won. The drinking contest, we got ready to leave the bar. The guy that's selling this and owned the bar was a city cop. And when we started out, well, he stopped both vehicles. And they wouldn't let me drive. I don't know why, but they wouldn't let me drive back. And when that cop stopped us, I was going to give him a cussing. And they stuffed me down at the bottom of the car to keep that from happening. That's why we took off and we got down the road a ways and stopped. We had to make a pit stop. I don't know how y'all was when y'all drank, but we made a lot of pit stops. I got to hunt my buddy in the other car. And they said, oh, he gave that cop a cussing. They took him to jail. Oh, hell, I'm not leaving my buddy, you know. I'm going back after him. Nobody'd go with me. They all piled up in one car, and we turned around, and we went. I went back, and I went to the courthouse, and jailhouse is upstairs above the courthouse, and I went in there and told them what my business was. I come to get Billy out of jail. I said, well, no problem. I said, well, where is he? He said, oh, he's upstairs. I said, well, can I go with you and get him out of? Oh, yeah. Says, but you can't bring nothing upstairs over there. You have to unload your pockets right here. We'll just put it in this little brown envelope. And whenever you leave, we'll give it back to you. I said, okay. So I did. We went up the stairs, and he went up there and opened the cell door and said, right in here. And it was dark, and I thought, well, he'd done laid down on that cot out there and probably asleep. I'm going to get him up before we could go. And I walked in there, and they shut the door on me. Next morning, me and Billy were both there in jail. And I knew better than call my parents, because after we left Lake Charles, Dad told me, he said, son, you get in trouble again and get in jail, you're going to get out the best way you can. I wasn't fixing to call him. And my buddy's father come and got us both out. And that was about it for that, you know. And I finished high school and went to college for a little while. And that wasn't for me. I didn't like staying broke. So I went to work in oil fields. And I went to work on pipelines. And we went to a little old town of Monroe, Louisiana. And down in South Louisiana, where I was raised, you know, we're drinking and driving them little old towns out there, you wasn't really cutting up, you know, they wouldn't bother you. Hell, we'd set a can of beer on the dash of the truck and, you know, just drive around. We wasn't really horsing up. They wouldn't bother us at all. But in Monroe, they were a little different. I stopped off and got a six-pack of beer and popped the top on it and drove about two blocks, and they pulled in the driveway behind me, and I got my first DWI. Now, that one I didn't really deserve. But Lord help me, I made a lot more than I did, you know, in it. So I found out what the DWIs was about. You know, they didn't like you in North Louisiana drinking and driving. And I was glad when we left out of Monroe, moved to a little old town of Lake Providence right on the Mississippi River. And I was standing in a truck stop out there and had a room right there at the truck stop. They had a little motel in that, and I was staying there. One afternoon, we got in early from the job, and we was all sitting in this truck stop out there drinking a little beer. Had a couple of gals that was playing pinball machine. Looked pretty good. And I got the question, trying to find out who they were. Well, they said one of them is the owner's daughter. and said, the other one's a preacher's daughter. Oh, yeah. Heck, I knew preacher's daughters down, you know, where I come from. They wasn't bad. And so I went by the pinball machine where they were playing and offered them something to drink. Boy, real snobby. Nope, you know. So I went on and got us a round of beer and went back to the booth, and they were standing there talking to my friends. Well, make a long story short, I had a date with this little preacher's daughter just the next day or two. And 6 weeks later, she and I were married. Real long courtship. And her dad married us, and he was a preacher in it. And I almost missed the wedding. I did miss the rehearsal and that. And I got my buddy from down home. I got him a job on the pipeline where he'd be my best man. And mother and daddy come down for the wedding. And they had to get us out of the bar to get us dressed to go to the wedding. And they put us in a little room over there and had that preacher in there with us. And we were chewing gum, doing all this stuff, trying to, you know, keep him from smelling the stuff on us. And he was so nervous and that he was smoking one cigarette after another. You know, he wasn't known whether we were drinking or not, you know. And so me and the little gal got married. And we started out on this great American dream, you know. And I carried her down South Louisiana, and she was raised up there in North Louisiana, and where she was raised was a dry parish, two or three dry parishes around there. So she'd never been around much drinking in that. And things went along pretty good for us, you know, when we first got married. She would go to the grocery store, and she'd buy some beer, and she'd bring home, and she'd keep in the refrigerator, you know. And I was in the union, so I'd have to go to the union hall every night and check on the job, you know, and I'd go over there and I'd forget to come home, and she didn't like that. You know, the union meeting lasted a little longer than we thought, and, you know, and we started working on the pipelines and that, and I got, you know, you worked 7 days a week, all kind of hours. I mean, we worked hard, but we played hard, you know. And we'd stop off, and a lot of days I'd stop. We had a trailer house. We were trailer house trash. And we'd pull them trailer houses, you know, around, because that's what most people called us when we moved into a town. And we spent a lot of money when we come to town. And we'd done a lot of drinking and a lot of other stuff, you know. And sometimes I'd park right across the street over there in a bar and drank till 1, 2, or 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, and truck sitting right in front. She never would come and try to get me out. And but we started having a little problem about my drinking, you know. We were married 4 years, and we had a daughter that was born. And she was my little sweetheart, you know, and it wasn't too much longer after that, another year or so, she got pregnant again. And had a little boy. That was the ideal family for us, you know. But the little boy didn't live but 6 hours in that. And that tore me up. And it did her, too. And she says that's when I really started drinking heavy. And we'd start playing the games, you know. You don't drink at my house, you know, nothing but beer. I done got where I was drinking hard liquor and all that. And you know, then you don't drink in my house. And, you know, and that didn't stop the drinking. Hell, I just drive the back road, you know, and I'd get hooped up, you know, and before I'd come home. And I'd come home, and if she had supper fixed, I raised hell because she had supper fixed. I wasn't ready to eat. You know, if I could get her on the defensive first, she wouldn't be on me. And we played these games, you know. We played these hide-and-seek games. You know, I got where I'd hide booze around the place in the hedges and in my boat and under the utility building and just wherever, you know, and where I could leave out of the house and get a drink in peace. And I got to, you know, after a while, I didn't really know what kind of whiskey I was buying, you know. It got where it was, sometime I get this loving whiskey, you know. Sometime I get this fighting whiskey. You know, and sometime I get some of this crying whiskey. Yeah. Just never knew what was going to come in the bottle. And it. I remember I'd get to feeling so sorry for old Joe drinking, you know, and I'd go out and sit over there at that graveyard and I'd cry and I'd cuss God. You know, because he took that boy away. And, you know, it just got where, after a while, that she just eventually said, you know, I'm not living like this anymore. And she says, I'm leaving. You can have everything. Well, me being such a fine father and everything, I said, no, we're not going to do that. I said, I'll leave. I'm not going to put my daughter out of her home. So I started packing, and you know how you do. You try to play every angle, you know, and I decided, you know, I went and grabbed me up a couple of old Piggly Wiggly bags, you know, and it wasn't because we didn't have suitcases, you know, but I wanted to make it look just as pitiful as I possibly could, you know, and then she would say, oh, well, that's okay. You don't have to leave, you know. But she sat there and watched me stick them jeans and shirts and drawers and them Piggly Wiggly bags, and she never did say, you know, no, you don't have to leave. So I left, you know, and I went down to, I had a liquor store down there, that old town of Arcadia, that I bought a lot of booze. He kept it by the half gallons for me. And old Taylor, 100 proof, oh, and by the half gallon, that's the way I bought them. So I went by his liquor store, and I was working at the time in a plant, paper mill plant over there. I was a heavy equipment operator, and I went by that liquor store, and I bought me 3 half gallons of whiskey, a couple, 2 or 3 cases of beer. And I went over there, and I, Monroe, and I just rented me a room close to the job in it. And really, at that time, I didn't need a wife. I didn't need a daughter. I really didn't need a job. You know, to drink like I wanted to drink, I didn't need all this stuff because that interfered with my drinking. But I got to drinking like Joe wanted to, except for a few hours that I had to work in that plant. And I got me a motel room and had a little refrigerator in there. And I carried them Piggly Wiggly bags in there and a couple of them half gallons of whiskey. I put one in the refrigerator and I hid one behind them Piggly Wiggly bags and kept one in the truck with the ice chest and the beer that I kept in there. And I'd go to work. And in the afternoons when I'd get off of work in the construction area, whenever the whistle blowed, everybody just rushed to their vehicle and see who could get out of that parking area the quickest, you know. Well, I rushed right in with them, right over to my pickup truck. I reached in an ice chest and I popped me a top on a beer. And I got that half gallon in a glass and put a little ice in it and put me some whiskey in it and fixed me a mixed drink. And everybody's about to run over, you know, trying to get out of that lot, you know. Like to say, you do first things first, you know, and that's what I was tending to. And, after I got my drinks all fixed up, you know, well, then I worried about whether my truck could crank or not. You know, and I'd go to that motel, and I'd drink until I'd go to sleep or pass out, whichever it was. And the next morning or whatever time it was when I woke up, first thing I done was fix me a drink and throw up. Fix me another drink and throw up. And I drank until I could keep one down. And I could tell when that drink got down there and was going to stay. And I knew I was going to be able to function another day. I'd be able to write my name where somebody could read it. Yeah. And I'd sit there and I'd drink until it's time to go to work. I had it timed. I wanted to get at the job, get through that gate just as the whistle blew. And I'd get to the job. Sometime I was still so drunk that, hell, they had to help me up on the crane out there to be able to run it. And once I got set in the seat and everything, you know, I could run it. I didn't mash a man's finger that I know of, you know, but it wasn't my skill. God was seeing about them. I was working with a bunch of boilermakers, and now they're a lot crazier than I was, you know, even drunk. Because they'd help me in the seat of that drag line out there, and then they'd go and jump on the headache ball and motion for me to put them up 30, 40 foot up in the air on scaffolds. You know, I wouldn't have done that, even, you know, drunk. And like I say, I was just lucky in it. One morning, I drank right up until work time. And I started out the door and I seen the keys laying on the dresser. I didn't use to take the keys out of my pickup. I didn't figure no way I'd wanted that old beat up thing no way, you know. But I grabbed the keys and walked out the door and my truck wasn't there. And I didn't have time to hunt for it, so I walked to this fancy motel's office over there because there wasn't no room, telephone in the room and told them to call a cab for me, and he must have been right around the corner because he picked me up just right away and carried me to work. And I thought all day long trying to think about where I went, what I done, you know, where I left my pickup. And I couldn't think about, you know, to have no idea where it's at. So that afternoon when the whistle blew, everybody headed for the parking lot, you know, just like everybody, you know, and I did right with them. And I didn't have no pickup truck, but they had a shopping center on that side of the road, and I eased over to that shopping center, and I called a cab. That same cab driver picked me up that afternoon, and I told him, I said, if you'll stop at the first liquor store you come to and let me get a bottle, I want you to drive me around Monroe and West Monroe, and look for my pickup. I said, I left it somewhere and don't know where I left it. Probably one of these joints. He said, okay. So we stopped at the liquor store and I got something to drink and we drove and drove, you know, until the bottle went empty and I said, hell, bring me back to the motel room. We'll look for it another time, you know. And he brought me and dropped me off at the motel and I done that for 3 days. Now mind you, any one of the guys that I was working with that'd give me a ride back and forth to the motel, but see, I couldn't let them know I'd lost my pickup. And the third day he picked me up and he had a passenger. And he said, you go look for your truck again. I said, one more day. And then I'm going to call the law and tell them somebody stole it. He said, okay. He said, I'll drop this passenger off and then we'll go. So he went and dropped the passenger off. And we come back by the motel, and the motel built in an L shape. And come back with the motel, but from a different direction. And there's sitting my pickup. On the back side of the motel with no doors. And I, you know, how it is, hell, I couldn't tell that taxi driver, hell, there's my pickup. You know, you can't tell the truth like that. And I said, oh, hell, just drop me off here at the motel room. I said, you know, I'm not going to hunt that sucker no more, you know. And he dropped me off because I couldn't tell him there was my pickup, you know. I don't know. I'd been drinking and laying around that hotel and motel over there for quite a while. And I was in pretty good shape one day, and I said, you know, I might ought to go check on my wife and daughter and see how they doing. And so I drove back over home, and when I got there, wasn't nobody there. Well, I said, you know, what's the deal? Nobody wanted to talk to me. I don't know why, you know. None of her folks wanted to talk to me or nothing, you know. But I eventually found out that she had taken a job. She'd working for an insurance company, and she'd taken a job at this insurance company and moved to Tyler, Texas. And, you know, how we can figure out these things, you know. Drinking a lot of stuff and paying that motel room. And I said, you know, I'll just save some money. I'll just move back home. So that's what I did. The job run out, and I was back home, and I was doing a lot of that good drinking, you know, with no interference. I didn't have to listen to all that. And static in that when you drank, and I was really, really doing all right, I thought. And I going back to this liquor store, this buddy of mine had this liquor store, and I get my booze out there. And what I liked about going to this liquor store, he would let me drink in his liquor store, which he wasn't supposed to. But I'd fix me something to drink, you know, and I sit on top of them cases of beers and whiskey cases in that, and I drank it, and I tell him what a fine fella I was and how great I treated everybody, you know, and how bad the world was treating me. And he'd listen to that crap, you know. And I'd go get him up. He didn't open until 10 o'clock. A lot of mornings I'd go get him up 6, 7 o'clock. And it wasn't because I didn't have something to drink. It was because I didn't have nobody with skin on around me, you know. And I'd go get him up and tell him I need something to drink. He'd go open his liquor store, and he'd listen to me tell him all this crap about what a good guy I was and how everybody was mistreating me, you know, and all that. And he'd tell me, he said, I used to drink like you. And I said, well, have a drink with me. Oh, not today, you know. He wouldn't never have a drink with me, and I was constantly trying to get him to drink with me. When I drank, I wanted everybody to drink, you know. And he wouldn't ever drink with me. And I went in his liquor store one morning and got him up. And we was got me a bottle, and I was sitting there drinking. And I had no intention of doing nothing but drinking. But it just felt like the world had come down over my shoulders, you know, and I couldn't carry it anymore. And I knew I needed to do something. I had no idea what the heck to do. So I asked him, I said, you drank like I drank. I says, if you drank like I did, how'd you stop? He said, well, if you ever feel like you got a problem with alcohol, let me know. He says, I know where some help is. And I guess it's the first time in my life I ever admitted to anybody that I couldn't quit when I wanted to. Quitting wasn't ever my problem, you know. I could quit sometimes 6, 7 times a day. I didn't know starting was my problem. And that, so he started telling me about the program Alcoholics Anonymous and me a drinking. And when I was drinking, time didn't mean anything to me. And I sat in his liquor store, so he told me later, until about 2:30 that afternoon before he could convince me to go home, talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, with a belly full of booze, you're not going to get a head full of AA, I'm going to tell you. But I remembered, he told me to go home. He said, you go home, and I'll call somebody and have somebody from AA come out and talk to you. And he said, tomorrow night, I'll carry you, me and you will go to a meeting, AA meeting. So on the way home, I got thinking about that stuff, you know, and he had to constantly be repeating it because I wouldn't have remembered it, you know, but about going home and somebody's going to come out from AA and talk to me. Well, I remembered one time or maybe two times, you know, I'd called Alcoholics Anonymous, and there wasn't nobody come out and talk to me. And I forgot when I called them, I didn't tell them who I was or where I was, you know. And old Big Glenn, he told him who I was and where I was. And I laid on the patio out there, passed out or asleep or whatever, you know, behind the house. And I remember some guy coming and shaking me and bringing me around and talking to me. And it was about 3 months later before I found out who that guy was. You know, I remember saying I had no idea what he said to me. Next morning when I come to, well, I remember Glenn telling me not to drink, that we were going to go to an AA meeting. And I put it off just as long as I possibly could, not to drink. And it was about 6 o'clock that morning, and I hadn't had a drink yet. And, you know, I said, I'm just going to take one. Just get me one drink to just calm down a little bit, you know. And so I went and I grabbed the bottle and that and started to take the top off of it, and the telephone rang. Well, hell, I knew that wrong number, but, you know, when you got them wrong numbers calling your house and it's ringing and you trying to take a drink, it's disturbing as heck, you know. So I'm going to get rid of this wrong number, and then I take my drink in peace. And I went and answered the telephone, and there's old Big Glenn on the phone. And then he says, have you had a drink yet this morning? No, I hadn't had one yet. And then he said, well, good, good. He just cheerfully could be that early in the morning, you know. He said, don't have a drink. And he said, we're going to an AA meeting tonight. And that, and I had that bottle, and I was just choking the neck of it, man. He talked on for a while. I didn't think he gonna ever shut up, you know. And he did, and I put the top back on the bottle and set it back on the bar, and I walked the floor. And then it got, what the heck with it? I'm gonna have me a drink. I don't care, you know. But hair lips whirl, and I grabbed that bottle and telephone rang. I'd answer the telephone. He'd read my mail. It's old Big Glenn. Hadn't had a drink yet, have you? No, not yet. You know. I don't know how many times he called me, but he'd read my mail. I'd reach and grab the bottle, and the damn telephone rang. And there at last, I was getting just a little bit agitated, you know. I'd pick up the phone and, hell no, I ain't had no damn drink, you know. And he'd just be just as cheerful as he could be on the other end. Good, you know, good. We're going to a meeting, you know. And, boy, I could have killed him, you know. And I'd put the bottle back up, and then later on that afternoon, it was a little bit easier not to want to take a drink. See my wife come home. Her and the daughter come in, and they didn't know I was staying there. And I didn't know they were coming. I wouldn't have been there. And she walked through the door, and she says, oh, I didn't know you was here. I said, well, I didn't know you was coming. She says, well, I'll leave and go to Mother's. I said, well, you can if you want to, but I'm going to be leaving in a little while. Myself, I said, I'm fixing to go to another one of them AA meetings. She just walked in the door. I done lied to her. And she's going to stay. And I had it all figured. Here old Big Glenn's going to come, pick me up to carry me to an AA meeting. And he's going to tell her, this is my first meeting we're going to. And she's going to catch me in another lie. See, I couldn't tell the truth. I didn't know what the truth was anymore. That stuff had made everything out of me that I didn't want to be. A cheat, a liar, a thief. But I had to sweat it, you know. And I was trying to get ready to go to this AA meeting that I didn't want to go to. And be ready when he got there where he wouldn't come in my house. And that didn't work out either. He come in and she let him in, and I poked my head out and told him I'd be ready in just a minute. And I could hear them talking over there, and I had no idea what he was telling her. And I got ready, and we drove out the driveway. You know, I was curious about what you had to do at an AA meeting. Because I'd never been to an AA meeting before, and I asked old Big Glenn, I said, Glenn, what do you have to do at one of these AA meetings? Nothing. Didn't say another word. Well, I don't know how y'all was, but when I'd been drinking a lot, I kind of had a one-track mind. I'd say the same thing over and over pretty regular, you know. So I asked him again. I said, what do you have to do one of these AA meetings? Nothing. We drive a little way. I said, Glenn. I said, what do you have to do one of these AA meetings? I said, you got to take an oath or anything like that? No. Don't have to do nothing. Went just a little bit further, and I said, Glenn. He said, listen, let me tell you something, boy. He said, the only damn thing you got to do, he says, get the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth and just listen. He said, that's all you got to do. Well, here I was doing that sucker a favor going to an AA meeting with him. And he talked to me like that, you know. If I didn't feel so bad and he wouldn't have been so big, I'd have tried to whip him. We got that AA meeting. I'd just like to know, just for curiosity, how many people's in this room that hadn't got about a year or less? Great, great, great. Let me tell you about my first AA meeting. That's the biggest bunch of liars I ever seen in my life. Another guy got up and got a 30-day chip and said that he hadn't had a drink. Weekends and all, you know. And I knew that sucker was lying. Heck, he knew where his bottle was hid just like I did mine. And he was going to go get him a drink when he left there just like I planned on doing. You know, and when we walked in that door out there, they had a little guy met me at the door. His name was A.C. Taylor. He's going to the big meeting now. And he followed me around this big church house room. It's great big. There's about 80 people there. More people than that. Way more people than I wanted to be around. And he got to follow me around this church house room, you know, patting me on the back and telling me how glad he was to see me. He said, man, you in good shape. You ought to see me when I come in here. You know, and I kept trying to get away from that little sucker. He kept following me around there and slapping me on the back and telling me how proud he was I was there and all this stuff, you know, and that I ought to seen him when he come in. And I thought to myself, somebody carried him in here on a stretcher, you know. Hell, I knew I had to get better to die. You know, I went that long without a drink, and I wasn't fixing to want to go that long ever again. You know, and they started that AA meeting. And the old man that was chairing the AA meeting was had 19 years of sobriety. Well, I go to give you a sobriety date. And it reminds me of the 13th, 1978. And when I went to that first meeting, I planned on it being my last. I'd get them people off of my back, you know, and I'd find out how they drank without getting in all this trouble. That's all I wanted, you know. And they got to really, really, you know, getting bad lies, you know. They had an old mechanic that talked, and he talked my language. He would curse. He would use in four-letter words and mix company, you know. And he had more DWIs than Carter had liver pills, you know. And then he lied. He said he had 7 years without a drink, you know. I didn't get much out of my first meeting because I figured all them people lied. But the only thing I did get out of that thing was a little hope. And that's all it takes, just a little hope that there might be something to this deal. Obey Glenn dropped me off at my house that night, and he said, I'll pick you up tomorrow afternoon. I said, you're going to pick me up tomorrow afternoon? He said, that's right. I'll pick you up tomorrow afternoon. And I said, what for? He said, well, we're going to go to an AA meeting. I said, isn't tomorrow Sunday? He said, yeah, that's right. He said, you got the day right. He said, tomorrow's Sunday. He says, did you drink on Sundays? I said, well, all right. He said, I'll be by to pick you up, just don't have a drink. I said, okay. So he came by, and my wife stayed there. Her and the daughter slept in another bedroom, and she stayed there until it was time for her to go back to Tyler to work. And she left. Big Glenn got there. Didn't have a chance to drink. He carried me to the Monroe to a meeting at the P farm, prison farm over there. And I didn't like going in there because, see, I'd been in there where they shut them doors on you, and they just, whenever they get ready to open the door, when they let you out, you know, and I didn't like that. We went in there, and that big old gate swung open, you know, and then it shut automatically behind us, and you never will forget the clanging of them doors, you know, and I didn't want to be in there. And we sat there, and there's all the inmates come in there, pretty little uniforms, you know, and come in there, and the black guy that was chairing the meeting, named Chuck. Chuck has meant a lot to my sobriety. Chuck's helped me a lot. And he was simple. Simple enough that you couldn't mistake what he said, you know. And he called my name to come up. Scared me to death. And old Big Glenn sitting next to me, and he just put her elbow in my rib and stood me up out of that chair. Go on up there, boy. And I went up there, and I was scared to death. And I don't even know if I told them people my name or nothing. Yeah, I was right back in that chair as quick as I could get there, you know. And they started that meeting in that prison farm. And I got to hearing them inmates' stories. I done everything they had done, you know, and I knew you could go to jail for drinking and fighting and all that stuff, but it never occurred to me you could have to go and stay as long as these guys had to stay, you know, and that scared me, because I was doing all these things, you know, and the only difference between me and them guys was they got caught and I didn't. And we got back to my house that night after that meeting. I told old Blake Glenn, I said, if you'll just wait here just a minute. I said, I got some stuff stashed out around here. And I'm going to get it and give it to you, and you carry it to your liquor store and give it to somebody who needs a drink. And Lord knows there wasn't nobody who needed a drink at that time any more than I did. And he took it. I never did ask him what he'd done with it. And he told me when he left, he said, you know, Joey, he says, I run that liquor store for a living. He says, I can't make AA meetings like I'd like to. But if you want what we have, there's going to be another meeting Tuesday night over at that church house where I brought you Saturday night. You'll find your way there by yourself. He's because I got to run that liquor store and I can't get off like I want to. So Tuesday night I found that meeting by myself. And I didn't have to hunt that sucker again for a long time. Not that I wasn't making meetings. There wasn't many treatment facilities around when I come in the program in 78. Not around our place anyway. I'd wake up in the morning at the house and I'd hear somebody whistling in my driveway. You know, and I'd go out there and there'd be one of them guys from AA. He said, well, I was just passing by. I thought I'd stop by and see what, how things was going. Well, I live on a dead end street. You just don't happen to pass by, you know. And he'd sit around, chew the fat for 30, 40 minutes, whatever, you know. He'd leave. They had shift work going. Wouldn't be long, there'd be another driving up my driveway. You know, and they say in this program, you know, a lot of us people wouldn't mix. There was a college professor. He was dean of the Department of Business at Louisiana Tech. Jim Hester, he's going to the big meeting now. He took a liking to me, I guess he did. At times I didn't know whether he did or not. You know, he'd call me up and he said, Joe, be ready, we're going to a meeting. I'll pick you up at a certain time. And he'd hang up the phone. You know, and we'd go all over North Louisiana, Arkansas, you know, up in the edge of Texas, Mississippi. We'd have to go anywhere, you know, to a meeting. Somebody say there's going to be a meeting, especially if it's an eating meeting, you know. They'd get there. And we started making them meetings, you know, and I was going to meetings regular. Every night we'd go in somewhere. There wasn't two in the town when I lived. There were two meetings a week. We'd make them 2 weeks, you know, and then we'd go in some other little old town around the area. And there'd be four or five of us going, you know, and we'd have a AA meeting to the meeting. And then we'd take inventory on the way back, you know. And, you know, I got to where I really learned a lot about the program Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought, you know. But that was my problem when I went to thinking. And Jim called me. He says, be ready, we're going to a meeting at a certain time. And I hung up, like he usually did. Well, I went to getting ready. Go to the meeting. But I got to thinking, like I said, you know, and the more I thought about this deal, the madder I got. You know, he told me he was going to come and pick me up, and we were going to meet at a certain time. Heck, here I am, a grown man, and he didn't ask me whether I wanted to go one of these meetings. He should have asked me whether I wanted to go to the meeting or not, you know? And by the time he got there, I done got in a rage. And they had two more guys with him, and they saved the front seat for me, you know? And when I come out of my house, I was just a few strides getting to his car door, and I already had the car door open for me. I grabbed that car door and I swung 1 foot in that door, you know, and looked him square in the eye and I said, by God, it ever occurred to you to ask a man whether he wanted to go to one of these damn meetings or not? Never did. Shut the door. Let's go. I shut the door and we went. You know, I didn't need them asking me anything. And they would tell me what I was thinking. That's another thing to get there. They would tell me what I was thinking, and I hadn't even opened my mouth. And if you don't do certain things, you're going to get drunk. Well, I tell you what, getting peed off at them old farts, I would stay sober just to show them they wasn't right. And it don't make no difference why you stay sober. The important thing is you do it, you know. Because when I got here, they told me I didn't ever have to take a drink again if I didn't want to. That if I would stick around these rooms, that I would see somebody go out there and take a drink from me and just hang around. And if they were lucky enough to make it back, go talk to them. See how much fun they had when they went back out. Well, in the length of time that I've been here, I got an opportunity to talk to several. And I hadn't had one come back in and told me it got better. Everyone said it got worse. You know, I've done this AA deal pretty good, and wife called me and says, "How about you still going to meet?" "Yeah." Says, "Well, how about you coming down the weekend? Spend a weekend with me and Paige, my daughter." I said, "Love to." We hung up the phone. I run to the liquor store, told my sponsor. He told me he was my sponsor. That's how I got my sponsor. And told him, I said, "Man, you might be telling the truth." He said, "What do you mean you might be telling the truth?" I said, "Well, you said things are getting better. It might be getting better." I said, "Wife called, want me to go spend the weekend with her and the daughter." He said, "Well, are you going?" I said, "Well, heck yeah, man, I'm going." He said, "Well, do me a favor. When you leave, stop by the liquor store and let me know you're getting off all right." He says, "Well, I won't worry about you." I said, "Okay." So I done that. That Friday afternoon, I stopped by. I go into Tyler, Texas. She'd give me direction. Never been to Tyler in my life. And that I hooked it for Tyler, you know. And went right straight to the, found where she lived, went up the flight of stairs, knocked on the door, went in, and almost got to shake her hand before there was a knock on the door behind me. Well, I said, she forgot to tell her boyfriend I was coming. So I went and sat on the couch. She went and opened the door. And there was a man's voice at the door. "Won't know if Joe Reed was there." Man, I wasn't drinking. I hadn't broke any laws. There ain't nobody supposed to be hunting Joe Reed. Nobody knew me in Tyler, Texas. I'd never been there in my life. And she didn't answer him. She just stood there. And I heard the man's voice again. Says, "Well, is Joe Reed here?" She says, "Yeah, right in here." And he just pushed on in by her. Little old bald-headed man, shorter than me, balder than me. And he says, "You Joe Reed?" And I says, "Yeah." "Well, good." He says, "I come get you to carry you to an AA meeting." Well, I tell you what, I didn't have an AA meeting on my mind. And I told him I wasn't going to, you know, what, AA meeting. And he says, "Yeah," he said, "I come to get you." And I said, "I don't care. I'm not going. I'm carrying my wife and daughter out to eat." He said, "Well, who's been carrying them out?" Well, I couldn't answer that question. He said, "Well, let me put it to you a little different way." He said, "I had a big guy from Arcady, Louisiana call me and told me that you needed an AA meeting and not to take no for an answer. If I had to sit at the foot of your bed, and I knew how crazy them people in AA was, he'd be there." And I didn't want him there, and I just looked over at my wife and said, "I tell you what, I'm going to an AA meeting." And we went to an AA meeting. Next day, he came over and knocked on the door, and it wasn't 8 o'clock. I went over there and opened the door, and I said, "Not no damn AA meeting this early." He said, "Now, what are you going to do today?" I said, "Well, a pretty good swimming pool. Wife's got to work a while. I sit around here and watch the bikinis." He said, "That's not good for you. I'll be back after you in a little while. Get ready." So I got ready. And he started hauling me around Tyler, Texas. And he was in a chemical selling business and had an answering service. And we got to stopping in all these places. And we had AA meetings every place we stopped. You know, and I knew that Tyler was dry, you know, and I thought everybody in town was blown to Alcoholics Anonymous over there, you know? And I hung around Tyler for a while, and I made a meeting every night I was there. My wife come in one day. She says, "You know," says, "they're fixing to move me over to Longview." I said, "Yeah." "Yeah," she says, "you going to help me move?" I said, "Sure." I said, "But after we get you moved to Longview," I said, I need to go back to work, so I'm going to ease back home and see about going to work." So we was moving her into her apartment down there in Longview, Texas, and I had to pick up, backed up across the sidewalk out there, and about to get through unloading everything off the truck. And a postman started coming down the driveway, you know, and I said, "Well, he's going to get teed because I got this sidewalk blocked." And then he walked right up to the truck, and he put his hand up on the bed of my truck, and he says, Are you Joe Reed? I said, yeah, are you from AA? He said, yeah. I pick you up tonight. We're going to a meeting. And that was Tom Patches, the drunk postman. And as long as I was in Longview, I made a meeting every night. See, they were doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. They kept me coming. And that's what we need to do. It's a repetition of this program that makes it work. You know. They told me there was 12 twos that would fit any nut. And that was them 12 steps on the wall. If they're applied, they will not fail. He said, this is the only program that's got a guarantee. I said, a guarantee? Yeah. Read the promises. Well, who are they? That's a good chore for you. Look in the big book. It's in there. And they do little tricky things like that to get you doing stuff, you know. I sat in this program on the fellowship for 4 years. I call myself working the steps as, you know, it applied itself to me. But my sponsor told me, he says, you know, he said, they number them things from 1 to 12. He said, do you know why they number them from 1 to 12? I said, well, you know how many there are. He said, no, well, you know which one comes next. See, I'd went 4 years without I caught myself doing a fourth step. And I did, mentally. And he told me one day I was crying and complaining about something. He said, yeah. He said, Joe, you do a fourth step? I said, sure, I've done a fourth step. Man, I've been in this program 4 years. Yeah, I know. I hear you talk. And he says, tell me how you done a fourth step. Well, I was kind of stumped there, you know. And he said, did you do yours mentally? I said, yeah. You ain't got nothing up out there to do it with. And he said, get you a pencil and a piece of paper and look at the big book. And he says, it tells you exactly how to do it. And it teed me off, you know, because he caught me. And I wasn't going to do it. I was going to do it my way. And I was about to get drunk. And I took pen in hand and I done what they told me to do. And I done the steps in the order that it came. And it got better. You know, I got inspired by two people here in this room today. Ain't Minnie down there, she my aunt now, see. 91 years old, 52 years of sobriety. If you're young in this program and got any questions about whether this thing works or not, come look at this little lady up here, sharp as a tack. I love her. Beautiful. And Miss Virginia. I've enjoyed all the speakers, you know, and every one of them has been great. I don't know if I helped y'all any or not. I hope you find the steps and find out how to live them. I never did like the word work. And that's not what this is about. See, I don't say Alcoholics Anonymous, give me my life back. But see, I didn't know how to live. I knew how to survive. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to live life on life's terms. Just because some of us got a few years of sobriety don't mean we don't hurt anymore. But we have the tools to get through it without getting in our problem. See, I know my problem is I can't drink successfully. And it took me a long time to find that out. You know. And everything else that comes up in my life is a situation that will pass as long as I don't go back into my problem. I thank y'all for being here. See, I found a God of my understanding in here. And these rooms with people just like you, my God works through y'all. He loves y'all to say the things I need to hear. Jessica helped me a lot. I needed to hear her. You know, I had to be taught how to pray. And my sponsor taught me how to pray. He asked me if I prayed, and I said, yeah, I do. When I got my tail in a crack, you know, I'm in trouble, I'll ask God to help me. And that was about the extent of my prayer. He said, I want you to pray. And I said, I don't believe in that crap. He said, I didn't ask you what you believe in. He said, I told you what I want you to do. I said, oh, yeah, what you? He says, I want you to pray, and I'm going to tell you what to pray. And I want you to say exactly what I tell you to say and nothing else. He said, if you wake up in the morning, God's good enough to let you wake up. And if you wake up in the morning, you ask God to help you. And don't say nothing else. Why can't I say something else? He said, because you little coon ass, I know you. He says, you're going to be trying to cut a deal. God knows what help you need. And if he's good enough to let you go through the day without taking a drink, you thank him. And don't say nothing else, because he knows what you're thanking him for. See, God's put a lot of you people in my lives, and I thank y'all. You know, my father told me, he says, son, if you live all your life and you're lucky enough to have one person in this world that you can call a true friend, you're going to be lucky. I'm real lucky. See, my dad didn't know nothing about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people that's in it, because I got a lot of true friends. And y'all have too, and there's not a thing you can do about it. Love you. Bye.